We've been focused on the last few weeks on the last 24 hours of Jesus' life before he's killed. And it's a time span that began at the beginning of chapter 22. And this morning, we're picking up on the story the morning after the Passover meal that Jesus has had with his disciples. And we're going to be looking at the trials of Jesus. I say trials, plural, because we have one at the end of chapter 22, and then another one with the Jewish rulers, and then one with Pilate. Plus, we also get an audience with Herod. And Dorothy is going to come and read the passage to us. It's from Luke 22, verse 66. It's quite a long section, through to chapter 23 and verse 25. Sorry, that's...
Jesus before Pilate and Herod. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. "If you are the Christ," they said, "tell us." Jesus answered, "If I tell you, you will not believe me, and if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." They all asked, "Are you then the Son of God?" He replied, "You are right in saying I am." Then they said, "Why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips." Then the whole assembly arose and led him off to Pilate. They began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis of charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he'd been wanting to see him. From what he'd heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us, as you see. He has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." With one voice they cried out, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who'd been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will.
Thanks, Dorothy. I don't know whether you've ever been in a situation where you felt resolutely out of control. When it felt like everything was building up against you, and no amount of your own effort was going to affect the outcome. Whether that's through sickness or an accident, or perhaps certain job situations or family predicaments. Imagine yourself there again. What were your emotions? How did you feel? Feelings perhaps of panic, of fear, of anxiety. If nothing comes to mind, then take a moment to imagine yourself in the shoes of Benyam Gazi. 250 guests gathered in a decorated hall in the city of Asmara in the East African country Eritrea. They were there to celebrate Benyam's wedding day. In 2005, the celebrations were in full swing when suddenly the doors of the hall were thrust open and armed, uniformed men marched in. All those present were arrested, including the bride and groom. The joyful celebrations ended abruptly, and the intimidated guests were bussed to the police station at the airport. Their crime? The wedding couple and 70 of their guests were thought to belong to members of a church. The church was called Meserite Christos. According to Christian Solidarity Worldwide website, 883 evangelical and charismatic Christians have been detained within the last 3 years in Eritrea by the authorities. Or imagine yourself in the shoes of Mohamed Tabu, a Tunisian lawyer who 2.5 weeks ago, on the 1st of March, marked his second anniversary of being in prison. His crime, according to Amnesty International, is thought to be when he spoke out against the use of torture in Tunisia, along with other criticisms against the Tunisian authorities. Amnesty International alleged that his lawyers have been denied access to him and that his wife has been physically assaulted during a number of visits to Mohamed in prison. Now 2 years in prison for speaking against the authorities. In both situations, it seems like nothing can be done. The two guys are powerless to change their circumstances. Here too in Luke, it would seem that Jesus is in a similar type of situation as he endures the trials, and that there's nothing seemingly that he can do to influence the events. It may feel that it's beyond his control. But Luke is insistent that Jesus is fully in control of these events. And his desire is that we see how these events fit into his book's ambition to demonstrate the fulfillment of God's promises. As we think about the trials, I want us to consider three questions, which are here. Why did the Jewish assembly want Jesus dead? Why didn't Pilate use his authority to release Jesus? And why didn't Jesus protest his innocence? So the first question, why did the Jewish assembly want Jesus dead? Having had him arrested, the Jewish leaders want to find some way of having him removed. They need a basis to have him removed, i.e. they want him killed. And their initial trial is at the end of chapter 22, at the start of our reading. Essentially, the religious leaders recognise that Jesus holds a considerable amount of sway and influence over a growing fan base. And they're scared of it. They're also convinced that Jesus holds no genuine claims to the power that he has. In their trial, they confront him about his identity. Have a look at verse 67. Jesus knows that they've already made their mind up. It doesn't matter how he answers, they will not believe him. They're only interested in having enough proof for a conviction, as implied in their statement of verse 71. Throughout the book, Luke has noted the religious community's growing concern over the influence that Jesus had. Right back in chapter 6, the plotting against Jesus begins. One of the clearest views of their intention that Luke records is in chapter 19, verse 47, which is there. Every day, Jesus was teaching at the temple, but the chief priests, the teachers of the laws, and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him, yet they could not find any way to do it, because all the people hung on his words. Then in the next chapter, chapter 20, Luke records, the teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately, because they knew that he had spoken against them. But they were afraid of the people. Keeping a close watch on him, they sent spies who pretended to be honest. They hoped to catch Jesus in something he said, so that they might hand him over to the power and authority of the governor. It's pretty clear that they think Jesus is too popular and he's a threat to their own authority and status, so they want him removed from public life. More than that, they want him dead. Their charge to justify the death penalty is in verse 70 of chapter 22, that he claims to be the Son of God, something that they firmly believe he isn't. But they have no authority to act out their desire to execute Jesus. Israel, as we know, is under the Roman occupation and as a result has to live by Roman rules. It's only with Pilate's permission that they can get Jesus killed legally. They acknowledge that much themselves in John's account of the trial in chapter 18. Their own religious trial will not justify killing Jesus. They need the weight of Rome on their side, so take Jesus to Pilate. The Jewish leaders know that Pilate is not going to entertain any notions of religious law breaking for the grounds of an execution. It makes absolutely no difference to Pilate whether Jesus is a blasphemer or not. So they change the basis of the charge. Look at verse 2 of chapter 23. They present him as a threat to Caesar, a rebel king who opposes the rule and laws of Rome. In verses 70, they wanted to know if Jesus was the Son of God. The nature of the charge has moved from being a religious problem to a political one. Jesus is now presented in verse 2 as a challenge to Roman law and rule. We should recognise that when Pilate asks his question of verse 3 of chapter 23, he's not asking Jesus if he's the chosen Messiah. What he is asking him is effectively, what is your political agenda? Are you here to threaten Rome as a rebellious king? And Jesus' answer is curious. In many respects, it doesn't look that different to the one that he gave the Jewish leaders in verse 17. But we should consider how John renders Jesus' answer in the same scene in his own accounts. In John 18, verse 33, which Vince will put on the overhead for us, or is it up there? It's up there already, actually. Pilate went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews? Is that your idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" Jesus' answer makes Pilate reflect on his own question. "Is that your idea?" Jesus responds. "In which case, are you really asking me, are you a political rebel? Or by contrast, have others talked to you about me? In which case, the question you're asking originates from the religious leaders. And you're really asking me, are you the messianic king?" Basically, Jesus answers by avoiding a straight answer. Instead, he leaves it to Pilate to consider the accusations being presented to him by the religious leaders, forcing him to take his own view. Back in Luke 23 and verse 4, Luke tells us that for Pilate, the idea that Jesus was some kind of dangerous rebel existed only in the minds of Jesus' enemies. He concludes that Jesus is of no threat to Rome's sovereignty and finds no basis for a state-sanctioned execution. In verses 4, 14, 15 and 22, Pilate insists again and again on Jesus' innocence. This is one of Luke's key concerns. He wants us to be aware that Jesus is facing his trial as an innocent man. None of the charges that are presented stand up. And certainly, they don't deserve the death penalty. So to our second question, why didn't Pilate use his authority to release Jesus? It's bound up with how Pilate views his own power and control, and how he prefers to use it. The same can be said for Herod, the regional ruler of Jesus' hometown. He also found no basis to execute Jesus, despite a lengthy Q&A session that we read about in verse 9. And when it's clear that Jesus is not prepared to roll out the Magician's Act, Herod loses interest in him. For these two brutish and paranoid rulers, Pilate and Herod's power was about control, having it and exerting it, making laws and enforcing them, reminding their citizens who is in control, and ultimately using their powers to serve their own purposes. In this instance, Pilate wanted peace on the streets. Herod wanted Jesus to jump, to perform. These are not weak-willed leaders succumbing to the whims of others, as is perhaps often assumed. One ancient historian described Pilate as being a stubborn, spiteful, bad-tempered, proud, and vengeful man. If either Herod or Pilate got a whiff of genuine political opposition in Jesus, they wouldn't have blinked before having Jesus sentenced to death. They would have seen him as a direct challenge to their own power and position. To them, Jesus is a joke. He's considered by them both as weak, as vulnerable, and someone who holds no credible power and is of no threat. Luke tells us that Jesus is mocked both by the Romans and Herod's guards. We read in verse 11 that the mocking is around Jesus' claim to be a king. This is a man that is facing his death and has nothing to say. Yet he's presented as a guy with some kind of control and sovereignty, supposedly a ruler of people. To Pilate and Herod, his power is empty, and he holds no genuine claim to be a king, nor a political revolutionary. I don't know whether any of you saw Mark Wallinger's statue in Trafalgar Square called Ecce Homo. It was in 1999. This plinth has been empty for years and years and years, and there was a rolling exhibition of different artists putting something on the plinth in Trafalgar Square. It's a portrait of Jesus as an ordinary, unassuming, shaven-headed man, naked except for a simple cloth around the waist and a golden crown of barbed wire. Wallinger said that his sculpture of Christ was not meant to be perverse or tongue-in-cheek. He says in his own words, "I wanted to show him as an ordinary human being. I think he has a place here in front of all these oversized imperial symbols." It caused a bit of a stir back in 1999, because the portrait was thought not to carry the weight and grandeur of a portrait of Christ. It's a life-size portrayal, and it was completely dwarfed by Nelson's Column and the other statues in the square. The statue was thought by some to look far too ordinary to be a proper representation of the Son of God. And yet, in reflecting on this trial, Wallinger's critics have reached the same conclusions of Pilate and Herod. This is just an ordinary guy of no consequence. It's far more likely that Pilate won't use his authority to release Jesus because it's not in his interest to do so. It doesn't serve his agenda. We can reflect on how corrupt and self-serving both he and Herod were by their complete unwillingness to release Jesus, even when they recognised his innocence. He's innocent. Why don't they let him go? Pilate says in verse 14 and 15 that neither he nor Herod could find anything worth issuing an execution over. But it's more convenient for Pilate to be swayed by the demands of the crowd to bring calm to the streets, in verse 24, than allow true justice to be honoured by letting Jesus walk free. Like the authorities in Tunisia and Eritrea from the stories at the start, the powers enforced over Ben Yam and Mohammed have been used seemingly at the convenience of the authorities, serving their own interests rather than the interests of true justice. So to our final question, why didn't Jesus protest his innocence? To best answer this, we need to recall Jesus' own words about his death. Jesus has been anticipating this moment for much of Luke's account. He's not been caught out by the events that are now unfolding and are now taking place. In chapter 9 and verse 22, we read of Jesus' instructions to his disciples. Peter has just confirmed who he believes Jesus to be, and Jesus replies with what he's come to do. And he said, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law. And he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." He speaks again in verse 44 about the certainty of his suffering. In fact, Luke records another 5 moments in his account. Have a quick look at them. This is Jesus' own words anticipating the event that he's now in. In total, Luke records 7 times when Jesus warns his disciples that what is now unfolding in chapter 23 should not come as any surprise to any of them, nor him. Luke is showing us that Jesus has not lost control of any of these events. He is not a powerless victim. Jesus does not protest his innocence for the simple reality that he's here facing this trial by choice. Vincent reminded us a few hours earlier in the garden, Jesus had a genuine choice to make. The choice to whether to follow his Father's will to the cross or not. And he chose to go the way his Father wanted. We should reflect on the fact that Jesus could have genuinely challenged the basis of the charges. There was no proof that he encouraged people not to pay their taxes, which is what the leaders were accusing him of, nor was he could be said to have caused an uprising or stir the crowds. The whole basis of the trial was full of inconsistencies. And we should not forget that he'd already demonstrated a formidable power equal to no one. Luke has written about Jesus giving a blind man his sight back. He'd healed 10 men of leprosy and restored a crippled woman. If he chose to use that power now in this courtroom, what courtroom could really hold him? Jesus doesn't use his power to serve his own agenda, in contrast to Pilate and Herod. He's there by choice. And he's there playing the role of the guilty man, facing a judgment, the mocking and humiliation, and accepting a punishment that does not belong to him. Unlike Pilate, Jesus defines his power by submitting to his Father's plans, choosing to serve a greater purpose beyond demanding his own right to personal justice. And we can see that greater purpose best in reflecting on Luke's inclusion of the circumstances around Barabbas' release in verse 25. Luke tells us in verses 19 and 25 that Barabbas was known as a rebel and a murderer, a genuine revolutionary who was in prison, convicted on the same charges that Jesus was being accused of. Now, you probably already knew this, but I didn't. Jesus was also known Barabbas was also known by the name Jesus. Many early copies of Matthew 27 had Barabbas' name recorded as Jesus. So in Matthew 27, verse 17, Pilate is thought to ask the crowd, "Which one do you want me to release to you? Jesus who is called Barabbas, or Jesus who is called Christ?" Barabbas shared the same charges and the same name as Jesus. 2 men standing before the mob, 1 innocent, 1 guilty. Can you Can you begin to imagine what it would have felt like for Barabbas to be set free over Jesus? And what it would have meant for him if he saw Jesus' execution? A guilty man, convicted and resigned to his fate, waiting for the sentence to be carried out, waiting for his death, who's now standing free, watching Jesus' crucifixion, perhaps saying to himself, "That is my cross, those are my nails, that should be me up there." Why didn't Jesus insist on his innocence? In John 12, Jesus said, "When I am lifted up, I will draw all humanity to me." Jesus chose to face this trial and execution, to face a bigger judgment than the one handed out by the Jewish leaders, a judgment far greater than the mighty arm of the Roman Empire. He faced the judgment of God in place of all of humanity, all of us. We probably all believe and support the idea of the importance of true and proper justice. As I read out the stories at the start of Ben Yangezi and Mohammed Abu, I would imagine that most of us felt concerned about what appears to be the enforced power of corrupt authorities. And all of us, I'm sure, would want proper justice to be granted to their situations. I imagine too that when we buy from the Good Shepherd Mission Fair Trade Stall, what we're saying is that trade and commerce would be fairer and more just if people were paid a proper price for their products and goods. We all believe in the idea of true justice, I'm sure, and also in the idea of consequences of those who are found guilty. The challenge of true justice, though, is that it can only work properly when it applies to everyone, when all of us are held to account by it and measured by it. It would not be fair or reasonable to expect justice to be handed to some, but not all. One of the big themes of the Bible is that God, the author of life, who has held us all to account against the standards of his will and his law, and he has found us all guilty. Yet by his infinite wisdom and love for us, he has seen fit to secure a way that does not discredit his justice and where the full consequences of our guilt are punished. Jesus stands on trial for us before God. He has chosen to act as the guilty one, despite his innocence, and to receive the full consequences of the judgment. Just as Barabbas was released in place of Jesus, so are we. We too can look at Christ pinned on the cross and say, like Barabbas, "That is my cross, those are my nails, that should be me up there." Let's pray.